you might look a little bit deeper and see if there's a feeling underneath all the planning. Sometimes with planning there's fear, sometimes anxiety. A lot of times our repetitive thoughts are a way of dealing with anxiety or fear, or they're a distraction so we don't have to feel the fear, the anxiety, the anger, whatever it is. So you might just explore a little bit, look a little bit, and see if there's an emotion underneath it. And again, with gentleness and acceptance, because our minds think. That's just what they do. And we don't want to make thinking a problem. Now, I know that's easier said than done. Certainly it is for me. But if we make a problem out of our thoughts, then we've just compounded things. We've added suffering on top of the thinking. And that's what's unnecessary. So the fact that you're noticing and coming back to the breath, that's the training of the mind. That's what's important. And maybe, I'm sure Gil has said this, an emphasis on that moment of waking up. You know, when you've been lost in thought and you wake up, there's that brightness. There's that moment of, wow. Focusing on that rather than our tendency is often to focus on, oh, I've been lost for 10 minutes or 3 minutes or whatever it's been. But try not to do that, but to focus on that wonderful feeling of being awake. Yeah. And understanding and accepting that this monkey mind, this continual thinking, is part of the human condition. And it's maybe magnified in this culture, in Western culture, where there's so much emphasis and so much value placed on thinking. Many of us live in our heads most of the time. It's really valued. So it's no wonder that our minds do that. The other thing is caffeine. Caffeine often tends to increase thoughts. And we're pretty much a caffeine-addicted society. So sometimes people will eliminate caffeine from their diets just for that reason. Good. That's not it. Great. Yes?
Several times, especially in these evening sessions with my physical body, recently cut down a lot on exercising, I'm wondering when it gets so intense, the struggle to sit still becomes so intense if I'm not just better off to get up and try it again the next morning rather than try to force it.
Forcing probably isn't a good idea. Yeah. A couple things. I would say take great care when you sit down, whether it's on a cushion or chair or whatever, to be sure that you're as comfortable as possible. Sometimes it's so easy just to sit and not pay any attention. And then 10 minutes into, you know, we're very uncomfortable. And it's because we didn't take enough care at the beginning to be really in good posture and well-seated. The other thing is, although it's encouraged that we sit still and not move, when it becomes a struggle, then the advice is to move. And I would say before you actually get up and don't sit any longer, see if there's a little adjustment you can make. See if there's some way you can readjust your body so you could stay a little longer. Also, you know, there are different postures. You don't have to be seated. Standing is a perfectly fine way of meditating. In fact, it's often recommended if we're sleepy because it's harder to be sleepy standing up. Lying down, lying flat is a possibility. Of course, the difficulty with that is falling asleep. The other is walking. And perhaps your body would be more comfortable if when it got to that point, you got up and just did some walking meditation. So you could still keep the mindfulness, but the body would be moving, and maybe that would help. Did you want to say?
How do you do walking meditation?
If we have time a little bit later, I'll show you. But basically, in Vipassana, the basic instructions are to find a spot about 20, 30 paces long. And the idea is not to have any place to go. Just so you're going to walk back and forth. And to walk slowly enough that you can really pay attention to the sensations of the feet, the legs, hips, and ultimately the entire body. It's the same as sitting meditation, except it's in motion. And instead of focusing on the breath, we're focusing on the sensations, focusing on the feet on the floor, the sensation of the body moving through space, and then the all the sensations that go into moving the legs. Sometimes, has Gil talked about noting, making a mental note? Sometimes that's good, at least at the beginning with walking meditation. And it can be something like as you lift your foot, rising, as you move your foot, moving, and as you put it down, placing. Now that means you're going very, very slowly, but it brings the attention to every single movement of the foot as you raise, move it, and set it down. So if noting is helpful, you can do that. Walking meditation is a way of bringing our mindfulness into movement and ultimately into everyday life. So like when we do one-day retreats or longer retreats, the schedule usually involves alternating sitting and walking, sitting and walking. For some people, walking meditation is easier than sitting meditation. For others, it's not. They lose mindfulness and it's more difficult. Anything else? Okay, well, the time is going by. Let's sit for about 15 or 20 minutes, and I'll do some guiding. I've never tried it. Nah, it's okay. It's okay. So find your comfortable, alert, erect, upright, as one teacher says, dignified posture, making sure that you're stable, either both knees on the floor, both feet on the floor, your back as straight as is comfortable, your chin just a little bit tucked, and eyes closed if that's comfortable for you. Your hands either in your lap or resting on both knees. And it's always a good idea at the very beginning to take a couple of deeper than usual breaths. Just to let yourself sort of settle into the posture. Let your body relax and bring your attention to right here, right now. And then allow your attention to come to the breath, wherever it is that you feel it most predominantly. At the nostrils, the throat, the chest, the abdomen. Let your attention rest with the breath. The sensations of breathing in and breathing out. Allowing the air to fully fill your lungs. And when you become aware that your attention has left the breath, notice what pulled it away. Was it a thought, a sound, a sensation, an emotion maybe? Just notice and gently return your attention back to the breath. And again, as you notice your attention has been pulled away, notice what pulled it away. And if it was a thought, what kind of thought was it? Was it planning? Was it judging? Was it rehearsing or remembering? Just note that and then return again to the breath. Enjoying that moment of waking up. Before I start talking, does anybody have a question or a comment about that sitting? Any experience for you or difficulty?
I found that when I did wake up, the word sane would come to my mind kind of involuntarily.
Sane?
Sane.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. I don't know if there's gratitude to it.
Beautiful. Yeah. Okay, then for the next little bit, I'll talk about the hindrances. There are five basic hindrances. They are, one, desire, usually spoken about as sense desire. The second is ill will or aversion. The third is sloth and torpor. The fourth is restlessness. And the fifth is doubt. And I'll try several times throughout the next several minutes to repeat those so that you remember them. The most important thing to remember from this talk is that these hindrances are universal. They're part of what comes with being human. They're not unique to any one of us, although we each tend to have a preference, a predilection for one or possibly two of them. We all experience all of them, all five of them, but usually there's one or two that are predominant for each one of us. But don't take them personally. When a hindrance arises, it doesn't mean that you're doing something wrong or there's something wrong with you or this is anything personal. It's just what happens. These hindrances come up. And so we want to work with them. They come up as we're meditating, and they come up in our everyday life. The thing is, if we're not aware of them, if we're not conscious and paying attention, then we get lost in them. We get dragged into them. And we can be lost literally for minutes, hours, days, weeks, months, years. They can be so powerful. So being aware of them, understanding them, is the best antidote, is the best way we have to dealing with them. Our mindfulness is truly the best practice for each of these hindrances. Now, I know from experience that it's easy for me to say that, and when you're meditating and you have one of the hindrances come up, it's not quite so easy to be very matter-of-fact about it. Oh, yes, I remember. This is one of the things that happens in life. This is one of the things that happens when I meditate. Probably for most of us, more frequently, your reaction is going to be something like, oh, darn, or not liking it, or getting lost in it. So again, just expect that. When that happens, just notice it and come back to awareness. So that, you know, as with everything, our relationship to the hindrances is what's so important. Not having them, or not the fact that we have them, but what is our relationship to them? Can we accept them as just part of what happens, just part of life? And get to know them, explore them, get to understand what they are. And as I said, each of us probably has a leaning towards one or two of them. So you can make that one the one that you're most likely to encounter or most drawn to, your study. Make it your exploration. Get to know that hindrance really well. Like anything, knowledge is your best defense. So the more you know about that hindrance, the more you understand it, the less likely it is to be a hindrance. It may still be there, but it doesn't have to be such a hindrance. It loses its hindering quality if it is understood and accepted. If we fight against it or indulge in it, then it has all the power. It is truly a hindrance. But if we are mindful with it and see it clearly, deal with it more matter-of-factly and not get so drawn into it or so averse to it, then it's just what it is. It's just doubt. It's just restlessness. It's just desire. And it doesn't have to be any more than that. It doesn't have to get us so involved. So I'll talk a little bit about each one. The first, as I say, is sense desire. Well, wait a second. Before I do that, let me read you a passage from Seeking the Heart of Wisdom. This is a very good beginning book, very good overall book by Joseph Goldstein and Jack Kornfield. And they say, how do these five hindrances interfere with our clarity of mind? There is a traditional analogy comparing our nature to a pond. And the point of practice is to see to the depths of the pond. Desire comes like beautifully colored dyes in the water that obstruct our vision. When we are angry, it is as though the pond were on a boiling hot spring. Again, we cannot see far. Sloth and torpor are like a thick layer of algae growing on the pond's surface. Restlessness is like a strong wind blowing on the pond's surface and creating waves. And doubt is like mud stirred up from the pond's bottom. Getting caught by any of these hindrances makes it impossible to see clearly into our heart and mind. So I think that analogy, if we can hold that in our mind, is quite useful as we think about the hindrances. As I started to say, sense desire or desire, if you think about the colored dyes in the pond, you see the seductiveness of that. You see the pull towards, oh, isn't that lovely? Oh, I like that. Oh, that's pretty. I'd really like to have that. That's the quality of desire. And many times people find they can be lost in desire during a meditation period for long, long periods of time. It is so seductive. It pulls you in. And you can start with one little thing. You know, you have a little sense of hunger, maybe. And, wouldn't a taco be good? And before you know it, the mind is off and running about not only a taco now, but an entire Mexican meal. And then planning how, when you leave here, you're going to go to such and such a place and get that meal. And maybe you're going to call a friend and say, why don't you meet me there? And the mind can just proliferate and go on and on and on and on and on for quite a long time, caught in this desire that started from just one little thought, or maybe started from just a little twinge of hunger. This is the power, the quality of desire. And it's often said that it's not the desire itself or the sense pleasure itself that is the problem, but our attachment to it, our clinging to it, the way we grab on and have to have it, our addiction to it. So with our mindfulness, what we want to begin to learn to do is catch that first little twinge, that first, in this case, sense of hunger and the desire to fulfill that that longing for food. And if we can, and of course we won't at first, but if we can get to the point where we catch it at first, then we see it for what it is. Oh, that's just desire. And we don't have to go down that long train of thought of planning and getting so involved in how we're going to take care of that desire. Or perhaps it's a visual desire. We see a lovely painting and decide that we have to have that painting. And so we go on and on and on about how can we get that painting and, how conspire maybe how we're going to get the money or plan a trip to that particular store so we can get that painting. And again, we're off maybe for minutes, hours at a time, caught up in this desire. And really, when we begin to see it clearly, when we begin to really study desire, we can see the unsatisfactoriness of it. Because once we get that taco or that Mexican meal, you know, it might be satisfying for a few minutes, for a little bit, but it's soon gone. And the very next day, we're hungry again, and we can be off on another tangent, this time Indian food or something. So we begin to see the power of it and the unsatisfactoriness of it, how it doesn't last. We think having this one great meal is going to bring us so much pleasure. And we find out we overeat, and it's not that much fun, or we're busy talking or thinking and we didn't even enjoy it that much. Or, as I say, it's fine for the moment, but a few hours later we're hungry again. And where's the Mexican meal? Gone. Gone. It happens over and over and over in our lives. And that, when we get drawn into that, when we get sucked in and get caught up in that kind of desiring, it leads to the if-only mind. And the if-only mind is the mind that says, if I only had that, then I'd be happy. If I only had the right relationship, then my life would be so good. If I only had a little more money, then I could relax and things would be okay. And as you can see, that just goes on and on and on. It pulls us away from the present moment, draws us into something that we think is going to be fulfilling, we think is going to satisfy us, only to find out that it doesn't. It's temporary, it's not lasting, it doesn't give us the satisfaction that we want, or it does momentarily, but it doesn't last. And in the end, nothing, nothing in this world will give us that lasting satisfaction, except freedom, true freedom. And these hindrances are the hindrances to that freedom, because they're what come in between. I like the analogy of a windshield. The windshield in and of itself is clear and bright, right? We can see clearly through it, but then it gets dirty. Mud splashes on it, insects get squashed on it, and it becomes very, very cloudy, and it loses that clarity, it loses that brightness. But the windshield doesn't go away, and it doesn't really change. All we need to do is clean it off, and there it is again. There is that clearness. That's like our true nature. Without these hindrances, our true nature shines. So if we can pay attention to these hindrances, see them really clearly, then they don't have to cloud our clarity, our clear seeing, and our brightness. The second hindrance is aversion or ill will. And this includes, each of them, of course, includes several categories or several elements, I guess. Ill will and aversion include things like anger, hatred, fear, boredom, judgment, criticalness, those kinds of so-called negative emotions. And just like the desire, there's a seductive quality. Some of us lean towards desire, others of us lean toward aversion. And we can get just as caught up in that aversion, that ill will, that unpleasantness, as we can in the desire. With each of the hindrances, I said mindfulness was our greatest ally, our most important defense. Also, we always want to be aware of where we're experiencing that in our body. You know, in this practice, we're always coming back to the body. It's an embodied practice. So with desire, often if we look in the body, where am I experiencing this, we can feel a tightness somewhere, the tightness of clinging or grasping. With aversion, hatred, ill will, that might be the one that's most obvious in the body, because often there is a contraction, a burning, heat. It's often a very unpleasant sensation or sensations. So sometimes that's the easiest one to see in the body. And again, we can go off. The mind can proliferate for long periods of time on anger. Something that somebody has done that has pushed our button, and we can spend so much time planning revenge. How many of us has not been lost in rehearsing what we're going to say, what we wished we'd said, what the other person said and what that means and how we're going to get back, and we can be lost for a long, 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 long time. So again, the point is to catch it, to see it for what it is, to see it as quickly as we can, as much at the beginning, when we realize that we're beginning to think about an event or something that happened. And we're beginning to rehearse, so we're beginning to go over it and over it in our mind. Notice it. And name it. Ah, there's aversion. There's anger. There's fear. Probably anger and fear maybe are the two that we tend to get most caught up in. Boredom sometimes. Judgmentalness probably a fair amount. One of the antidotes to judgmentalness or judgments is to count them. And then it can become even funny, you know, when we get to 335 in a 45-minute sitting. It becomes pretty ridiculous. We see the ridiculousness of our judgment. So seeing it clearly, seeing where we experience it in our body, seeing the effect it has on us and on others, I'm sure all of us have had the experience of being angry and seeing the effect that anger had on somebody close to us, somebody that we yelled at, somebody that we mistreated. And we've all been the recipient of somebody else's anger and felt the closeness of it. Usually with aversion, there's a closed-heartedness. We're not open. We're not loving, but we're closed and contracted. And that's as unpleasant for the people around us often as it is for us. As we begin to see the unpleasantness of it, to see the effect it has on our body and on our mental state, on how we feel, on how our day goes, on how we relate to people, it might become less and less attractive. And we might want to be more mindful, more vigilant about the beginning of it. It can be very useful to see the trigger. What is the event, thought, sound, or whatever that is the trigger for that anger or that fear or that desire? Because if we watch carefully, usually there's a trigger. And if we see that, then that's the point at which we can bring our mindfulness and hopefully not go down that long path. Fear, as I said, is a big part of aversion. And I think many of us live with fear a good bit of the time. Sometimes we know it. Sometimes I think we don't even know it. Fear can rule us, and we're not even that aware that that's what's going on. Fear can be very uncomfortable. The sensations in the body can be very uncomfortable. And we don't like that uncomfortable feeling. And fear is not, it can be considered weak, or it's not generally a very accepted or positive kind of emotion. So there can be aversion to it. There can be a desire not to experience it, not to feel it, and therefore not want to explore it, not want to see it clearly. Sometimes what we do is flip to anger, because oftentimes, you know, there's energy in anger, and often we're more comfortable feeling the anger than we are the fear. So we can very quickly flip to the anger, and the fear goes unnoticed. When we're feeling anger, therefore, it can always be valuable to look underneath it. It's said by some that anger is always a secondary emotion. I don't know if that's true or not. Maybe it is. That there's always something underneath it, and fear is often the feeling that's underneath it, or hurt. So if we notice anger, if we bring our attention to it carefully and ask what's underneath, then we might see the fear or see the hurt or something else that is fueling that anger. And of course, that's what we want to get at. What's fueling it? As I said, any of these hindrances are ways of taking us out of the present moment. So they're defenses in that sense. Or they're a way of rescuing us. Rescuing us in the sense that if we're lost in the hindrance, then we're not experiencing whatever it is in the present moment that we don't want to experience. Whether it's fear or some other sensation or something else that we don't want to experience, we don't want to recognize. Then we get lost in a hindrance, and we don't have to feel that. For me, it has been sometimes physical pain. If I'm sitting and I'm experiencing pain in my back or my leg, and very often then I go into one of these hindrances, usually doubt. Doubt is my favorite hindrance. And I'm lost in that, and then I don't have to experience the physical pain. So it rescues me in that sense. And that's part of the seductiveness of the hindrances, that they do rescue us from being with something that perhaps we don't want to be with. So if we see what that is, we may not like it very well, But if we're serious about doing this practice, then we can gradually learn to be with whatever the unpleasantness is and not get lost in the hindrance. The third one is called sloth and torpor. I think that's always fascinated me. Sloth and torpor. And sloth and torpor can mean just plain sleepiness. Sometimes we lead such busy lives that we come to meditation and our bodies relax, maybe the mind relaxes a bit, and we get sleepy. Often that is an indication that we're not getting enough sleep. And the best antidote is to get more sleep. But the other side of it is, or another part of it, is an avoidance. Again, not wanting to be with something. Something that's unpleasant in some way. So we get lost in sort of a trance, a dreamlike state. One teacher calls it drifting and dreaming. It's that, you know, kind of twilight zone where thoughts may kind of come randomly. There may be images. There may be, it may be pleasant in some way, but there's not clarity. We're not mindful. We're not really present and alive. You know it because you know when you wake up, you know the difference. You know the clarity of being fully present and awake. And so then you realize what it is when you drift into that drifting and dreaming sense. So the idea is to bring more energy. Do what you can do to bring more energy. And during meditation, that can be, first of all, maybe just sitting up straighter. If it's just a little bit of sleepiness, then sometimes just sitting up straighter will bring more energy and you'll wake up. Often it's more than that. And then I find opening my eyes really helpful. I'm not as likely to drift into that trance state if I have my eyes open. Now, sometimes I've found there's such a pull to it that I can hardly keep my eyes open. I open them and I just get drawn back into the sleepiness or the sloth. Then standing up. Standing up is perfectly fine. It's a perfectly fine way of meditating, and it is a way of bringing more energy and more awakeness. It is much more difficult to fall into this dreamy state, this trance, this sloth, if we're standing up. Then when we get up, we can do things like getting some fresh air, splashing cold water on our face, perhaps walking. Anything that's going to bring energy to us. Sometimes focusing on something will allow us to come out of that state and be really present. Other times, though, it's that concentration that can lead to the dullness. So we have to be careful with that. If it works, great, but sometimes the sloth and torpor is a result of so much concentration but not enough energy. And so we want to be aware. If that's what it is, then concentrating, focusing on one thing is not going to help. It's not going to bring us that alertness, that awakeness. When we're doing a day retreat, or even when you're just coming here for an evening, it's a good idea not to eat a heavy meal, to eat kind of lightly, because, of course, having a lot of food in your stomach is almost a sure way to know that you're going to drift into a trance or a sleepy state. So eating lightly can be helpful. The fourth hindrance is restlessness. Restlessness, agitation. It can make it quite difficult to sit still, to sit on the cushion when we're experiencing this restlessness. It's often, you know, an internal restlessness, but it can manifest in a body restlessness. And again, this is often an escape from something. So one of the antidotes is considered to live a moral life, to pay attention to what you do, so that when you're sitting on the cushion or sitting in the chair, however you're meditating, you don't have all this remorse, regret, all these thoughts about what you've done come up and create this agitation. I think it's Gill that tells the story many years ago of a man coming to him who said, "In my profession, lying is just part of the deal. How can I learn to meditate and continue doing this in my profession?" And the answer was, "You can't." Lying and meditating are incompatible. So is stealing. So is any unethical, immoral conduct. If we're going to do that, we're not going to be able to sit and meditate and concentrate, because that act is going to keep coming up. It's going to surface, if not right away, if not sooner, then later. So being careful about our lives, paying attention to what we do, following the precepts, following the basis of non-harming, is a way to reduce the restlessness, the agitation that we might feel in our practice. Also, hanging out with, what do I want to say? The word good comes to mind, and I didn't want to use that, but with like-minded people. Hanging out with people who are also interested in the Dharma, are also interested in leading an ethical life, following the precepts, so that we're not pulled into doing things that are going to create agitation in our meditation, so that we have the support of a sangha, a community of practitioners who have the same intent that we do, who are intent on leading a skillful, a healthy, a moral life. That supports us to do the same thing. And that keeps us from being pulled so much into things that are not going to be so conducive to our meditation. There's a lot in the world, right, to seduce us, to pull us in. Advertising, that's the whole point, to seduce us in play on the hindrance of desire. So it's important for us to be careful where we put ourselves, where we hang out, where we put our attention, so that we don't get pulled into these things so readily, so easily. Then the last of the five hindrances is doubt. Little doubt and big doubt. And little doubt can show up in lots and lots of ways. We can doubt ourselves. Maybe that's the biggest. Maybe that's the foremost doubt. We may doubt that we have the ability, that we're able to do this practice. We may doubt our worthiness. We may feel that we're not really worthy of freedom. We're not really worthy of a more calm, a more peaceful, a happier life. It may sound silly, but that's there for a lot of people, that sense of unworthiness. We can doubt the teachers or a teacher. You know, we sit with a teacher that there's something we don't like about him or her. We don't like the car they drive or the clothes he or she wears or the way they speak or something. And we can decide, well, if this person represents Buddhist practice, I don't think I want anything to do with it. We can doubt the teachings themselves. We may be drawn to them, but at the same time have this resistance, you know, well, what is this really about anyway? This is just a bunch of nonsense, or this isn't going to get me anywhere. We can doubt the Buddha, you know. Who was he? So what? He talked about suffering, so what? What does that mean for my life? There's many, many ways that we can doubt. We can doubt our fellow Sangha members, our fellow practitioners. So again, the key is not to get lost in the doubt. Doubt, I think, is one of the most difficult hindrances because it's so easily believed. And Gill likes to say, we doubt everything, but we don't doubt the doubt. And I know I have found that so true. I can doubt lots of things, but I sit with the doubt for hours and think that it's perfectly true. It's perfectly real. So there's, again, a very seductive quality about doubt. And again, it's so important to see it for what it is. This is the edge for me. When that doubt comes in, to see it as doubt before I get so caught up in it that I'm lost in it, and then it's very difficult to see it as doubt. I experience it as real. It's true. I don't have that distance or that clarity. So if you know that doubt is big for you, or that doubt is your common hindrance, then when you begin to experience it, you know, be vigilant, notice it, catch it, name it. Ah, there's doubt again. And we don't want to make doubt or any of the hindrances enemies or problems or make ourselves wrong. We just want to know them really well. We want to see them and understand them so that they don't hinder us. So that we know them for what they are. Ah, it's just doubt. Oh, there's doubt again. Okay, I know this. I'm familiar with doubt. I don't have to go down that road. I don't have to believe it and get pulled into it. Then there's the great doubt, which is said to be very helpful. And that involves living with the questions, who am I? What is freedom? What is suffering? And these are not necessarily questions that call for an answer, but they're questions for us to live with. And that these questions are useful. These questions are helpful. They ultimately lead to freedom. So they're not the little doubt. They're not the doubt that we get caught up in and get lost in. They are the questions that are useful, that we can live. So again, let me read just a short paragraph. The path of awakening is our great and wondrous legacy as human beings. It will often be difficult and at times seem almost impossible. Thomas Merton writes, "True love and prayer are learned in the hour when love becomes impossible and the heart has turned to stone. When we remember this, The difficulties we encounter in practice become themselves part of the fullness of meditation, a place to learn and to open. They are the juice, part of what makes us alive. Working with these hindrances will lead us to great insight and great understanding. So it's not as if we necessarily welcome them, but when they're there, we see them and we can use them. Use them to understand. Use them to see more clearly. Use them to investigate, explore, and see what keeps us from freedom. What muddies our windshield and keeps us from seeing things clearly. So I'd like to suggest to you that over this next week, you really pay attention to the appearance of these hindrances in your practice, as you meditate, in your daily life. And see for you which one is most predominant. See if you can notice all of them, because they're all there. But see which one is most predominant, or which one or maybe two you experience more often. And as you do, as you begin to notice that, then begin to explore it and see it as fully as you can. This will take more than a week, of course, but you can start this week and pay as much attention as you can to the occurrence, the appearance, the arising of these hindrances, and of course the passing away of them also. So, are there questions about the hindrances? Desire or greed, attachment, aversion or ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness, and doubt.
Mm-hmm. Worry fits under doubt.
Worry, yes. Mm-hmm. Well, actually, it can also fit under aversion. Worry is often considered aversion.
What about suggestibility or compliance?
Say more.
Suggestibility. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of metaphors used here that suggest pleasant images from nature, but you're seducting them. So that answers it as sense seduction, basically.
Can be, sounds like. Yeah, that seduction, that drawing in. Do you mean experience that you feel suggestible? That if something is said,
or something, whatever's said,
that pulls you in?
Yeah. Which obviously has to happen to some degree, but
yeah, I could see where that could also be aversion. That those of us with aversive personalities, we could be drawn into the aversion, the suggestibility of aversion as well. Mm-hmm. Anything else?
Doubt is the only one without a dead end.
What do you mean? Without
just an observation. All the rest are paradoxical. They feed each other. They start each other. They assist each other.
Yes.
And they all run in loops. Mm-hmm. The only thing they can ever mm-hmm. do is return to themselves. Doubt is the only one with an element that is enclosed.
The great doubt.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
Just didn't even know why it's in the same list.
as a way of distinguishing, I think. As a way of seeing the difference between the little doubt that we get caught up in and the great doubt. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You talked a lot tonight about the things that keep us from just focusing on our breath, right? The things that fill our minds.
Or the present moment, from being present, yes.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about what it feels like when you overcome those things, what the experience is like?
To not be lost in a hindrance? Sure. We all experience it at different times. It's that feeling of waking up. That moment of recognizing, I've been lost. For many of us, it's thinking. You know, we're lost in thinking. And then something happens that wakes us up. And for a moment, it might be an instant, it might be several minutes, we're fully present. We're fully awake and alive. There's nothing in the way. There's nothing happening in a way. We're just present.
I guess that's what I was trying, more than just the initial instant of waking up, because I find myself, when I'm meditating, catching myself, waking up, and then moving on to the next thing, I get lost.
Right.
So
I'm
trying to imagine what it might be like to have that stretch out for a few minutes to get past the initial waking up before getting lost in something else.
Right.
Would be over a span of a few minutes.
Yes. So what I would suggest is what I said earlier, to put your attention on that moment of waking up.
But that in itself is almost a realization. That in itself is almost a thought.
It can be. It doesn't have to be. It can be just pure awareness. But we're so habituated to, you know, making ourselves wrong, or like you say, going off to the next thought or the next thing that pulls us away, that often we miss those moments. We come back, we go off, we come back, we go off, we come back, we go off. And we're not paying a whole lot of attention to that moment of coming back. And so that's a training. I mean, we have to train ourselves. But it really is possible to begin to put our focus on the waking up. Wow. It really is pleasant when we do it. It's very, very pleasant. It's alert. It's awake. It's lovely. And so if we can keep reminding ourselves, oh, yes, enjoy this. You know where I do it that's very helpful? I'm a swimmer, and in the swimming pool. That's one of the most useful places for me to focus on the waking up, because when I wake up and I feel the water, especially if it's nice and warm, if the sun's out, you know, it is so pleasant. And the body, of course, is light and buoyant in the water, and it's a very, very pleasant experience. And so that's a good place for me to focus on the waking up, because it's so pleasant, it's reinforcing.
Why isn't having the meal at Taco Bell or whatever reinforcing the same way? That's a sensual experience.
It can be. If we bring our mindfulness to that meal and we pay attention to the sensations, the taste of the food, the entire experience with our mindfulness, that can be a wakefulness. Now, it's mindfulness and wakefulness as it's happening, the experience. The meal itself is not going to last. But we can bring the mindfulness to any experience, anything that we're doing. And it brings a different quality. The symphony is another place, or the ballet, that I find it really much more pleasant. since I've done this mindfulness practice, I enjoy the symphony and the ballet so much more because I'm really there. And when I get lost, I come back very quickly. It's another good place to see the value of waking up. Because when I'm lost, if I'm lost in thinking, or which is usually what it is, then, you know, they can play a whole piece or a part of a piece, and I've missed it, really. The sounds have gone in, but they haven't registered. But when I'm paying attention, then I really hear it. Then I begin to hear patterns in the music, and I can pick out different instruments. It's a fuller, richer, much more enjoyable experience.
You mentioned that doubt was your favorite, your personal favorite. Probably one of mine as well. Mm-hmm. Did you ever have difficulty making the shift to not believing the doubt?
Did I ever? Do I still? It's a practice. I have to continually remind myself. Now I can be both in the doubt and know that I'm in the doubt. So there is more distance. I'm aware that I'm caught in the doubt. It can still at times, it's much, much shorter, but it still at times can be very powerful and feel like it's real. Often what's useful is that after I'm out of it, when I'm really clear, maybe talking to somebody or something, then I can look back and then it's so obvious that I was caught, that I was in this trance of doubt. That helps me then the next time to have a little more awareness and not be quite so caught. It does take practice and it does take vigilance. Whatever your favorite hindrance is, it'll pull you back time and time again. And so that vigilance, we talk about hindrance attacks. Sometimes we can get attacked by all five at the same time. But that's just a cute way of saying that it can be so compelling. It pulls us in. But as I say, for me, when I'm clear, then looking back and seeing, oh, I was just caught in doubt again, that helps me the next time then, even if I'm in it, to have enough objectivity to say, oh, I'm caught in doubt again. And if we do that enough, it loses its quality. It's like anything. When we're caught in it, it's in charge. But if we're aware that it's there, that it's happening, it doesn't have the same charge. It doesn't have the same power over us. It may still be there, but it doesn't control us in quite the same way. Does that help?
So the starting point is just to recognize that you're in the doubt. Whether that's in the moment or even after.
That's right. And to begin with, it's probably after. And then it moves up closer and closer until you see it when you're actually in it. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is restlessness always a result of not living what you say is a, quote, moral life? Could it also have features of living in our modern culture where we have too many responsibilities and are greatly overstimulated by them?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It can be a result of caffeine. Yeah, it can be a result of a lot of things, right?
I don't know where this would fall, but this ego, kind of self-congratulatory kind of... I mean, I think for me, I have doubt, but I'm more like sort of maybe the other extreme. It's like, oh yeah, I really know what I'm doing, you know? And so I have to stop myself from doing that. I don't know where that fits in the scheme of things there.
Yeah, I'm not sure offhand either. Do you have a thought?
Well, usually when I'm congratulating myself, I'm
I want to feel something that I am, other than I am. Mm-hmm. And so it's a form of aversion for me. Mm-hmm. It's I really don't want to feel bad about myself, so I congratulate myself.
Yeah. Good point. Yeah. So, like with everything, looking underneath it, you know, what is this? What's happening? Well, it's after 9, so I think we should stop. I'll be around for a little bit if people have questions. I'm sorry we didn't get to sit anymore. It's a big topic. And as far as I know, Gil will be with you next week. So have a good week. I'm sorry. Oh, list them again? Yes, desire, or clinging, or grasping, aversion, or ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness, and doubt.